Blog Talk Radio.
The opinions expressed on Wolf Dog Radio by our guests and call-in listeners are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of the production team of the hosts of Wolf Dog Radio. We are open to your ideas for future radio programs. Please feel free to email us with questions or comments at questions@wolfdogradio.com.
Well, hidey-ho, neighbors. Good evening. This is Greg Largent, and I'll be your guest host for this evening. What's going on in your world? We hope everything's good. Tonight, we have the pleasure of being joined by Mr. Greg Hill, who's the project coordinator for the Wood River Wolf Projects. The Wood River Wolf Project is a collaborative effort of conservation organizations, ranching operations, and county, state, and federal agencies working together to use proactive, non-lethal deterrents to minimize livestock and wolf conflicts. Since 2008, the Wood River Wolf Project has been helping Blaine County ranchers in central Idaho implement non-lethal strategies to successfully reduce livestock losses and protect the native wildlife. The Lava Lake Institute for Science and Conservation serves as the fiscal sponsor for the Wood River Wolf Project. I'm going to read a little piece here that's entitled A Peaceful End to the Wolf Wars. That's written by Brandon Kelm, April 5th of 2017, from a newspaper in Idaho. In 2007, a family of wolves in Idaho's Sawtooth National Forest killed 9 sheep. Ranchers who owned the sheep asked for government wildlife managers to kill the wolves, but local wolf supporters and conservationists protested, asking instead for a non-lethal solution. So began what became the Wood River Wolf Project, a landscape-scale, multi-year experiment in how ranchers, livestock, and wolves can live together peacefully that encompasses over 260,000 acres. Nearly a decade later, the results are in, and it is a resounding success. In one of the most intensely grazed regions around, non-lethal wolf control led to, quote, the lowest loss rate among sheep grazing areas in the wolf range statewide, unquote, which was written in the Wolf by Wolf River Wood Project researchers in the Journal of Mammalogy. Coexistence, not killing, was best for livestock. After these brief messages, we'll return with our guest.
He's a dog in every sense, yet in his soul, he's a wolf. Inside every dog lives a spiritual connection to his ancestors in the wild, and nothing connects them more than a desire for meat. So we created Blue Wilderness. It's made with more of the meat your dog loves. Feed the wolf that lives inside your dog with meat-rich Blue Wilderness.
This is Paula Ficarra.
And Steve Westell.
Founders of Apex Protection Project.
And you're listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Good evening. Tonight I have the extreme pleasure of speaking with Mr. Greg Hill. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks, Greg. It's good to be here. Glad I can be a part of this broadcast.
We thank you. Yeah, this is going to be a really good broadcast and give people a lot of good information. So we're very pleased. Thank you. Can you give our listeners an introduction of just what WRWP is all about?
Yeah, so the Wood River Wolf Project is a collaborative organization or collaborative group of conservation organizations, ranchers, scientists, federal government agencies, state management agencies, and county officials that all work together to promote the coexistence of livestock and wolves through the use of non-lethal measures that prevent depredation. So this group is really it's really quite the accomplishment to bring everyone together from different backgrounds and interests to work together towards a common goal of helping not just conservation of wolves and wildlife, but also helping the ranching community as well. And we're currently entering our 11th year here in 2018. And we are a part of the nonprofit organization, the Lava Lake Institute for Science and Conservation, located in Haley, Idaho. And our project is, we're a small operation. We currently only employ 3 paid staff, but we operate over a very large scale. Our project area where we do these coexistence efforts and work together is a 1,200 square kilometers that includes national forest land, Bureau of Land Management, and private grazing lands in Blaine County, Idaho. So essentially what the project uses to help promote this coexistence is a combination of predator presence surveys, non-lethal deterrent tools, herder training, and really maintaining human vigilance to try and achieve 4 main primary goals. And these goals include minimizing the number of sheep depredation events by wolves, minimizing the number of sheep lost to wolves, and eliminating or minimizing the need for lethal control of wolves, and also saving livestock producers money. So it's a very all-encompassing organization that has found a way to work together on what is traditionally quite a volatile issue.
That's a lot of mouthful you just said there, and it's excellent goals. Obviously, being in existence for this year, 11th year, you must have some really fascinating data for as the years progress and more non-lethal deterrents are utilized, and to see how that interacts and reacts with wolves. So that's really, really great. I hope we can touch on that a little bit later on in the interview. How did the Wood River Wolf Project get started, Greg?
So the project has been officially in existence for, like I said, for 11, it's going on its 11th year now. However, the seeds of the project were really sown all the way back in 2002. Now, this was, obviously very shortly after the reintroductions, not only to Yellowstone, but also into central Idaho. And the now president of the Lava Lake Institute for Science and Conservation, Brian Bean, and his wife, Kathleen, also own a ranch, the Lava Lake Ranch, which is located right in the project area in Blaine County here. And back in 2002 was when they first started experiencing problems with wolves with their livestock. So Brian and Kathleen are a couple of great people. They operate Lava Lake Ranch, which has about 875,000 acres. And they're sheep ranchers that have been here since started the institute in 2004. But that, as I mentioned, back in 2002, they had a number of incidents involving wolves, including one depredation event where they lost 36 ewes and lambs in one night, a 6-hour period actually, and another event where they lost 25 ewes and lambs and one guard dog to wolves. And this all happened, these are just single events. And one of the big take homes here, though, is that these were Brian and Kathleen are very conservation minded ranchers. And they decided, early on, when forming the Lava Lake Institute and this ranch, that wolves were going to be a target conservation species for them. So what they did was reach out to Defenders of Wildlife to help them figure out how to become experts in the use of non-lethal deterrents, because they essentially said, look, you know, we want to participate in conservation of wildlife and wolves, but we want to defend our sheep at the same time. So how can we find a common ground here? And since then, after reaching out to Defenders, they've had great success in using these non-lethal deterrent strategies. Now whenever they do experience a depredation by sheep, it's usually only once or ever, or depredation by wolves on sheep. It's only once every 2 or 3 years, and when it does occur, it's usually only a few animals. And furthermore, they have never actually requested a lethal control of wolves while operating, which is a huge success. But that was Lava Lake Ranch's story. Now, the Wood River Wolf Project itself got started around 2007, when we had what was known as the infamous Phantom Hill Pack come into the Wood River Valley here. So the Phantom Hill Pack has two things that made it quite the infamous pack. For one, they were a pack of all black wolves. So that, and the fact that they lived in a place called Phantom Hill only added to their allure. And this was in 2007, this was before delisting, and they were having major problems with this pack running across Highway 75 and killing sheep almost every night, just on a regular basis. And we had there was a big division here in the community between people that wanted to support wolves and wildlife, and they loved seeing these wolves, but also ranchers that wanted to protect their livelihood. So this was when Idaho and Blaine County really took a monumental step in the direction of conservation, in that they, instead of taking the traditional approach of lethally controlling wolves and just removing them, we were able to sit down, thanks to Defenders of Wildlife and a number of local conservation organizations and county officials, we were able to sit down, get ranchers, scientists, all these conservation organizations and management agencies into a room and talk about how we can not only protect the wolves but also the sheep at the same time. How can we solve this problem together? And that is what really started the Wood River Wolf Project. And since then, it's been very, very successful. As you mentioned, we have had some of the data, if you really want to look more into it, is available in a Journal of Mammalogy paper we recently published, which documents the project's success over the course of the first 7 years. It shows that when you can get everyone together, when you can get people from different backgrounds to work together towards a common goal, you can have incredible results. And within that paper, we document depredation rates on wolves, or depredation rates by wolves on sheep in the project area, are 90% lower than the rest of the entire state of Idaho, according to the USDA National Agriculture Statistics Service. And furthermore, within the 11 years that the Wood River Wolf Project has been operating, we have never once had a lethal control request within the project area. So it's a dual success story, in that we've been able to keep wolves from being killed within the project area, but also keep the sheep safe and save these producers money.
Yeah, that's nothing but a win. That's a win-win situation for everybody, and you and everybody else involved, and especially the ranchers. It's so easy for them just to yell and scream and pick up the phone and demand a removal program than to actually roll their sleeves up and get involved and do something proactive to you know, to help not only the sheep keep their sheep safe, which is their primary goal, but also had to have a goal of keeping the wolves from being killed, and removed. So that's excellent.
Yeah,
we would love to have the link to that study if you could provide it to us.
We can definitely do that, and it's not to say there weren't tense moments. You know, this had never occurred before in Idaho, and for that matter, in many other places in the West. So the big accomplishment here, possibly you could argue that even bigger than keeping sheep safe and both sheep and wolves safe, is the fact we actually got everyone to sit down and talk about how to do that. You know, oftentimes with issues like this that are so emotionally volatile and have quite the history of division in them, it's the human element that's the toughest part to get going. And in that, so to be able, it kind of, this project really answers a bigger question that you could, especially in America right now, is how do you get people with different opinions to sit down and try and find a common ground and work towards that.
Yeah, they just have to sit down and give things a chance to work. Along that line, I read an article a couple of days ago that the French government is passing legislation or wants to pass legislation that would require the French farmers that have tens of thousands of sheep across the country who are, from what their claim is, being depredated very severely by wolves. It would require them to utilize non-methyl methods and dogs, or their compensation for depredation would be severely impacted. And that is a huge change in the direction of the French government for the good. And obviously the farmers are not happy. And they're a huge voting bloc and power bloc in most of Europe. The farmers and the sheep owners and cattle owners that there are have a huge voting bloc. So it's good to see that at least France is taking a proactive stance to protect both, not just send in the helicopters and the hunters, and that so many European countries sadly seem to be doing, that they're maybe going to lead the charge towards doing something along the same thing that you all have been doing, and you know, give it a chance to work and go from there.
Yeah, and I think that brings up another good point, is that when it comes to lethal control, like you have to be sensitive to the livelihood of these ranchers. I mean, they're not the evil guys or the bad guys that sometimes they're made out to be. They're simply concerned about their livelihood. And when you have a lot of these ranching operations that are already hanging on by a thread, and you have an event happen, say like what happened on Lava Lake Ranch that I mentioned earlier, that for some people that can put them under. And that brings up the point of, when you're talking about this issue and how to find a way to work with people, you can't use statistics. You can't just go up to them and say, oh, well, you know, the USDA says that wolves only account for 1% of the total mortality. Well, it shows a complete lack of empathy if you go up to someone who's just lost a ton of sheep that basically can put their entire ranch under. It's almost like going up to, you know, the victim of a mass shooting and saying, well, I'm sorry for your loss, but shootings only account for a small percentage of deaths in this country. It's not going to be met with a good sense of understanding there. So how we, you know, how we communicate is really important, and that is a key in order to work together to, for a common goal. And furthermore, lethal control, it costs taxpayers money too. It's like you mentioned, if you're going up in a helicopter, that's not cheap. So finding a way to prevent the problem before it starts is really, it's the most effective solution, and it's the better long-term solution, since as we've begun to see, livestock depredation is a learned behavior. So once it starts, it's very difficult to stop, which really speaks to the importance of programs like this, where making sure you can have a plan in place to keep it from becoming a problem to begin with is the best way to save everyone time, money, effort, and social strife in the long run.
Exactly. Have you just one more sidebar question, and we'll move on to the next question. But have you had any interest from ranchers outside of the 1,200 kilometer test area in the Wood River Valley that are looking at this as something that they may use in their part of the state for to try as a non-lethal deterrent?
Yes, we've had a number of inbound calls, even from other regions of the world, but we also have, right now in Oregon, Eastern Oregon wolves are becoming quite the hot topic. And we have been talking with Shane Stevenson, a sheep rancher in Eastern Oregon, who is really taking this, he's also taking these deterrents to another level even. And we're starting to learn more and more from him as well on how you can apply these techniques to different environments. And it's a never-ending process of learning. You're constantly evolving your strategies to figure out how they can best suit a certain situation and environment. So it's not like the work is ever done. It's not like we've figured it out and there it is. You have to always be working towards finding ways to make this as effective as possible, because nothing's perfect, but you got to be able to continue to perfect your craft.
Exactly. Speaking of the non-lethal deterrents, Greg, can you describe what those are and what their presentation is?
Yeah. So as I mentioned in the opening comment, there's essentially a three-pronged approach to the Wood River Project's plan, which is predator presence surveys, use of non-lethal tools, and also outreach. And we'll go over them one by one here. So the first one being our wolf/other predator presence surveys, which in my opinion might be the most important pillar of this plan, in that if you can know where wolves are to begin with, it's the first and most important step in preventing a problem from happening. So if you can figure out where a pack is or a pack location, you can then implement a strategic grazing plan and be prepared so that you can do your best to avoid conflict to begin with. And we do this in three major ways. One is a howl survey, which is actually where we will go out to a high point in the landscape at dawn or dusk where we suspect wolf activity may be, and we will actually howl ourselves or play a recording of wolves from a sound device. And usually if there is a wolf pack in the area, frequently they'll howl back. And then what you can do is play those recordings of those wolf responses through a spectrogram and figure out how many wolves were in a pack and also if they have any pups. And now this is a really crucial aspect of that of this portion of the plan, because if you know how many wolves are in an area, and particularly if you have any pups, you can know the relative location of where to stay out of, but also how to utilize things like the number of guard dogs you're using, because wolves will have a predator protective response where if you are running a band of sheep with too many guard dogs near that a denning site, you can actually increase the risk of conflict because wolves will be that much more protective of their pups. And so howl surveys being a very important part of this, but also the use of camera traps is something that's becoming increasingly popular in many wildlife studies, but also is a very effective way for us to gather information about movement corridors and abundance patterns of not just wolves, but also their prey. So you can get a good sense based on the number of pictures you gather and the locations where they're taken of where prey is moving through, where predators are moving through, in areas that could be potential problems. So this helps us do a dual purpose. This is another dual purpose survey, though, in that it really helps us document diversity and abundance of wildlife within the project area as well. And finally, we conduct a lot of public informant networks where essentially we have trail signage, we get reports from local individuals on where wolves are, and that really helps us plan our other surveys, our howl surveys and our camera trap placement as well. So that first step is a really important one when it comes to avoiding conflict to begin with, but also you can't always, it's not perfect, and you can't always avoid problems. Sometimes you have to have the tools in place for when wolves are in a given area. So our non-lethal deterrent tools are a combination of lighting, sound, and flagging devices. So as I'm sure a few people have heard of flaredry is a popular one, but we also use fox lights, high-powered spotlights, starter pistols, boom boxes, and any sort of human vigilance is actually the most important. Human presence is the most effective deterrent. If you can establish that you're in an area around the sheep, that's probably the best way of keeping wolves out. But one thing to really consider here is that these tools are really, their use is really environmentally specific and situational. Certain tools don't work that well in certain environments. Now, for example, turbo flaredry is something in low elevation areas that works very well and can work for a certain amount of time, but it's not something you want that's easy to be stringing up in really high elevation areas. So figuring out which tools work where, when, and how is a really important aspect of figuring out how you can best prevent depredation or prevent wolves from coming in, but also mixing things up. You know, you don't want to use the same deterrent too much. You don't want to use all of them at once, and you want to cater each one of these devices or the combination of them to a specific situation, as I mentioned. So based on where you're at in the terrain and geography or topography of a given area.
So it's not just going out and putting some rocks in a tin can on a string and hope they knock the can over or make it rattle when they touch something. So yeah, that's very involved, I'm sure. It's there's a lot of, it's science based and trial and error, not just, you know, go out and stomp around in the weeds. And so that's very interesting. Thanks. The Does the Wood River Wolf Project, do you have a plan or something in place that reaches out to youth and tries to educate them early on about the coexistence issues with wolves?
Yeah, that's one of our that third pillar there. That's one of the things we're really trying to emphasize more and more now is continuing to raise awareness, because it is a complex issue. It's not that easy to explain in certain areas, especially when you consider the preconceived notions many people have of wolves and everything that surrounds them. On one side, you still have people that believe they're going to run down the streets and eat our kids in school bus or at school bus stops. But at the same time, you have to go back into areas where they haven't dealt with wolves for a while and wolves are starting to come back in, and educate them about about wolves themselves and what is true and what isn't true. So we do Q&A sessions. We've set up wildlife trivia nights in the local community here. We've actually done a number of trips abroad to speak on this issue and show that the coexistence is possible if you can get people together to do it. Brian Bean, president of the Lava Lake Institute for Science and Conservation, he's been to Washington, D.C. twice now. He's spoken at the House Committee on Natural Resources on the subject of wolves and how we can coexist with them. I've been to Colorado 3 different times now to participate in panel discussions and speak at various events on how you can implement strategies in areas where they may be moving into or where wolves may be moving into. We've done a lot of outreach, both locally here and abroad and in other states, to kind of give a good sense, to make sure people understand that there's a lot that's involved with getting along when it comes to such an issue like this. And doing the local school stuff here in the community is also a lot of fun. I remember doing a Q&A session for a school here, and all the kids really, half of the questions were about alpha males and females. It was kind of funny, they all want to know. It's sort of a popularity thing or something. It was quite the cool thing to see how interested kids are nowadays in wolves, but also which parts of the wolf issue interest them the most.
Yeah, it must be very interesting to hear their questions and to be able to plant the seed, so to say, of giving them information that's first fact-based and truthful, and makes their young minds think of things, so they hopefully do some research on their own and don't get penned up in the big bad wolf and all the stories and everything else, because I'm sure in that part of the country it's I know it's a hot topic all over, but especially in the states where the wolves will come back. So
you don't want the myth to be continued, but at the same time you want people to understand, especially from a young age, that it's going to take work on all sides, and it's not going to be always something that's easy to deal with. So it's really, like you mentioned, it's really making sure people understand the truth behind the matter, but also that there's a way in which we can do this together.
Exactly. Truth and reality. There you go. Livestock guard dogs, is there a difference in breed, male, female, whatever, that you utilize and look for?
Well, out here we typically use Great Pyrenees or Akbash. We have found, however, that Akbash tend to be a little more aggressive So I would generally, Pyrenees are used more often, and we try and keep it to about 3 to 5 dogs per sheep band. And now a band of sheep out here on these public lands, on these grazing allotments, can number between about 900 and 2,400. And it's a lot of sheep. They're one band walking through a stretch of forest. So I've heard a number of producers say that they think the most effective deterrent is to have as many dogs as possible around them, usually about 6 or so. And these also the guard dogs tend to be the most effective in the most rugged country as well. As I mentioned, things like certain tools like turbo flaredry don't work that well in the steep terrain, but the guard dogs do. It's been another aspect of trial and error and research in where you use them and how many you use, based on time of year, as I mentioned, so you can try and avoid that predator protective response when wolves are denning or where they may have pups in the area. So they're a key component of protecting the sheep, and they're also raised with the sheep, so they imprint on them. So growing up, these guard dogs, that's what they know as their pack, their herd. They associate with the sheep from a very young age, which helps out a lot out in areas where it's tough to keep, it's really difficult to keep a tab on that many sheep in that big of an area. So it's really helpful to have a 150-pound animal that can hold its own and make a lot of noise. And they're pretty adorable as puppies too. So there's that to add.
Exactly. non-lethal deterrent. You've touched on a little bit in your some of your previous responses, but is there anything else you'd like to add about such things as environmental, geographical, animal types, herd, flock size, or anything that would kind of goes to their uses as well as the non-lethal deterrents?
Yeah, I touched on it a little bit before. I'd say the number one thing, and if you can get it, this is a little harder to get going sometimes, is number one thing is human vigilance. You really have to be on top of, you really have to be on the ball when it comes to making sure you know where the herd is, and also making your presence known. As we say, there's no substitute for a well-trained herder. So making sure your herders know what to do in a given situation, how to use the deterrents, and communicating with the camp tender, with the foreman, with the ranch itself, so that you can respond in a timely fashion, is really, really crucial. That's one thing we do. We've done as part of our outreach plan here is put on herder training workshops. We actually went out to East Oregon again this past summer and put on a workshop on how to use these lethal deterrents to some of the ranching operations in areas where wolves are starting to become much more of a presence. So we'll have just even having herders pee around the flock, spreading that human scent is a big way to announce your presence. But it's also a matter of, as I was saying, constant evolution and listening to the ranchers in different areas on what works and what doesn't. I've had ranchers tell me there's a gradient of buy-in by the producers in terms of which tools are the most effective. And talking to my field manager, Chris Thorson, who's also really dedicated, he's out there putting up cameras, he's out there checking in with the herders, along with one of our collaborators, Kurt Holton, he put in 360 miles this past summer looking for wolf sign throughout our project area. Talking with those guys and with the producers themselves, we've come to start to see that there might be some of the most effective things could be kind of putting together what we call our Delta Force package, where it's just a simple compilation of tools where you have a starter pistol, some Fox lights, which are these, I don't think I mentioned before, for those out there that don't know what a Fox light is, it's a solar-powered light that flashes at night and simulates humans on patrol. So having a few of those, a starter pistol that can fire off some cracker shells, and a few spotlights, something that's easy to carry in a saddlebag, is oftentimes what a lot of operators have told us may be the most helpful, because we've created what we call these band kits, which are a compilation of all the tools you can need, but they are very heavy. So it's not as easy to lug them around, and after you've spent a long day on the range herding sheep, it's not something you want to carry or set up all the time. So making sure you've got something that's easily applied is also another key to the use of these deterrents.
Yeah, it kind of goes back to the KISS theory. Keep it simple, stupid. It's just, use what works and what's light and fast and easily grabbed and used. That's good. It's a feedback from not just you all with the project, but you have to have the feedback from your dedicated people that are in the field checking things, and the ranchers themselves, along with the producers who, they're there for a reason too. But like you say, it's the information coming from the people actually on the ground involved is immeasurable. We humans, as we are sadly today, how do we coexist with wolves as they expand their range across the United States, and especially now that they're coming into Colorado?
Well, that's a $1 million question now, isn't it? It's a very complicated one. And one that, again, I'm going to go back to something I mentioned earlier, is more of a human issue, I think. It's more of a how can we, as people of different backgrounds and interests, work together to deal with this issue. And I think a lot of that starts with learning from the past. And that is, making sure that we're prepared to deal with this as they come back in. Because when they were reintroduced into the West, it was kind of, there was this sense of, well, here they are, now let's deal with it. We don't have to do that now. We have a better idea of how to deal with this issue and how to take into consideration everyone that's affected by it. There's a saying I've heard, it goes pretty true, is that like a lot of people that, the majority of people that love wolves aren't the ones that necessarily have to live with them. And that's a statement we really need to think about when we're talking about reintroduction into another area or recolonization into another area. We have to have a plan in place and go into that. You have to have a plan in place and collaborate with everyone involved and start that education process all over again. We want to perpetuate this quote-unquote box-tool biology and all these myths we mentioned earlier. We want to make sure that people know there is a way that we can deal with this issue that can help both parties or all parties involved. And that is, that's something that involves making sure that we have a fair management plan in place that accounts for all the significant factors, ecological, cultural, socioeconomic, prior to them coming in, or to the wolves coming in, that is. And that's the best way that I believe we're going to alleviate the volatility of this issue so that it's not so touchy and so that we can sit down and have a discussion about it. And then the other thing to consider is that it's not just the wolf itself that creates a problem when it comes to their expansion, when you're talking about recolonization or reintroduction. There's this sense of, you know, government intrusion that I'm sure a few people out there have heard, you know, wolves have been called government-sponsored terrorists because they were just kind of, there's a sense from these communities that they were just put there and boom, now we have to deal with them. So we really want to try and consider that when we're talking about should we allow them to recolonize an area or reintroduce them? Because that's going to have a big impact on the social acceptance of them coming into an area. And along with that, there's a big aspect of sticking to a plan. You know, we want to avoid this, I've heard it called the pushing the goalpost scenario back, where you have an agreement between management agencies, organizations, and stakeholders that says this is what recovery looks like. This is what the number of wolves mean. This is what a recovered population is based on the number of wolves we have, and now we need to start thinking about managing them. If we keep having this scenario where we say, well, no, they're not recovered yet, but we agreed on it, you're going to create more hostility towards the issue. So taking that into consideration is a big, big factor. You know, we need to realize that just because the state has a plan in place, or let me rephrase that. Just because you have an agreement of what recovery looks like, you have to stick to that. And that's the way you're going to get people to agree and buy into projects like ours that will promote coexistence. You know, you've got to remember that the old West, as we know it, has changed. The physical and social geography have changed, as well as the speed and the magnitude of wolf dispersal. So though that has to be taken into account. And remember that just because you're afraid that some people say they're going to kill all the wolves doesn't mean that's going to happen. Regulated hunting does not necessarily mean extermination. Here in Idaho, you know, they have the wolf killing contest just north of us, and there's been a lot of comments about the right number of wolves in Idaho is zero. But when it comes down to it, we've got almost 800 wolves in the state. So if you take the steps in place to protect the habitat and you consider everyone, you consider all the stakeholders involved, you can find a way to exist to where you have a healthy wolf population and you can have livestock on the landscape with them. Just because someone says something doesn't mean someone says there's all, or I should say, there's always going to be that group of people that are never going to want wolves there. But it doesn't mean that the wolf can't exist in that area just because that paradigm exists. And, you know, lastly, I'd like to add that we have to realize that coexistence is not always going to be pretty or clean. you know, they, you have to have, for one, you have to have lethal control on the table for operators to buy in to the use of non-lethal methods. That's just how it is. And that there's going to be bumps in the road. You're going to have problems, and there's going to be learning curves, but you have to be able to, you have to be able to overcome those and work, find the best way possible to work together.
I can understand. I mean, I don't think anyone is, there's a huge amount of people that, you know, don't want any wolves killed ever, but that sadly isn't that's not the reality of the wolf recovery system. It was never a part of the reintroduction system. If people would go back and read the actual reintroduction paperwork and what's involved with it, there is a number of animals per area or region, breeding pairs as to when they, you know, the animals have been reintroduced successfully. So, you know, it's a sad reality, but like you said, you know, hunting doesn't mean extinction or extermination. And when you have animals that, you know, for whatever reason, that's just something they start doing, that you can't stand with the producers and the farmers and, you know, standing with flashlights and boom boxes and the non-lethal deterrents. If you use them and they don't work, then that doesn't leave a lot of latitude for a decision. And sadly that happens. So it's a two-way street, like you said, give and take. And I mean, you've got 11 years of solid management and solid figures and data to go back on that. If given a chance, guess what, folks, it works. It's just, you know, it's a, you have to give it a chance to operate and work. So very good. The last question we have for you, Greg, what's new this year with the WRWP, like upcoming events or news or updates or things that are coming ahead for you?
So we are, we're planning a couple of things for this upcoming field season there that we're hoping to get off the ground at least. And one is we have started to work with Boise State University and Dr. Neil Carter, who is an assistant professor there, works with human dimensions and wildlife management. And we are essentially going to be expanding our camera trapping efforts to include many, many more cameras throughout the project area. You are using about 60 to 70 total to integrate what we are calling corridors for coexistence study, where we're looking at not just wolf movements and predator movements, but all animal movements throughout our project area to add on to the project and answer another question of, you know, not just how can we help reduce conflict between livestock and predators, but also answer the question of how are we as humans, with a growing population and growing interest in outdoor recreation, how are we impacting the animals in our communities, and how can we manage public land use so that we can avoid negative interactions between animals and humans. So we're really excited about the possibility of getting this off the ground. We're really hoping that can give us some vital information about how we can better balance outdoor recreation with conservation-based management practices. And furthermore, this has become quite the important issue in our local community here, as recently, with just this winter, we've had 3 dogs killed by mountain lions in the Wood River Valley alone. So understanding these abundance patterns and population dynamics and where animals are moving in given times of year is a really vital key to helping avoid these kinds of problems. But we're always looking for volunteer opportunities. People like to come out and do things like hole surveys. It's a lot of fun, and obviously it's a chance to hear wolves out there in the wild. And we are also collaborating with the organization Great Old Broads for Wilderness, which is another nonprofit that is a group that focuses on keeping public lands in public hands. And we're putting on a conservation awareness event in the Wood River Valley June 21st to the 25th. So if anyone wants any information on these events, have them feel free to contact me at my email, greg@woodriverwolfproject.com, or also visit our website. And if anyone wants to be on our newsletter list or our mailing list, have them shoot me an email. I'd be happy to add them to that list. And, of course, since we are a pretty small nonprofit, we're always looking for any help from a donation standpoint is much appreciated. We're trying to amp up and be as prepared as possible for the coming year, so we appreciate any and all help on that front. And furthermore, like I said, contact me or visit our website if you want to know how to get more involved with the project and anything else we've got going on. So. And there's one last statement to go along with kind of signifies our major mission would be, there's a quote from our one of the Blaine County Commissioner here, a member of our steering committee, Larry Schoen, is that a big take home from what we do here and our mission as the Wood River Wolf Project is, if you can prevent depredation in the first place, it's the least costly and safest alternative for everyone involved. So I think that's a great way to sum up what I've said here.
Yeah, if you can nip it in the bud, then you don't have the issue. So that's, yeah, well, I really, really appreciate your taking the time to be with us. I'm sure you've expanded my knowledge base immensely on what you are and what you do. And it's a great thing to know that the project is expanding to other parts of the United States and internationally. So that, you know, others are obviously seeing the good work that's being done and the positive results and are interested in incorporating those into their areas or countries to, try to have some coexistence and everybody get along and live on the same land.
Yeah. And, you know, there is, as I mentioned, it's not going to be easy, but in the end, it'll definitely be worth it for everyone, I have a feeling. So it's something that it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of cooperation, but it is possible. And I believe that our project has shown that. Now it's just a matter of figuring out how we can do this in other areas and how we can get people to buy in.
Exactly. Take the mold and hop, skip, and jump across the goal line and make it work in other areas. That must give you an extremely good satisfaction to know that, it's not only an ecological plus, but it's, the coexistence factor. So thank you, Greg. We really appreciate it. And all the information that everyone has heard Greg speak of will be on our website, should be there by now for you to go to and check in. And we urge everyone to contact Greg and the Wood River Wolf Project online and become more invested in protecting not only the wolves, but the coexistence with the sheep and that are wildlife. Thank you, Greg. We appreciate your time well spent. We have a couple of brief messages before we have a message from Project Coyote.
Does your dog suffer from bad breath, itchy skin, or any of the other common canine ailments? Check the ingredients on your dog food. Do you see wheat, corn, potato, or rice products? Is there a long list of synthetic vitamins? Your dog has the same digestive system as a wolf, coyote, dingo, or any other kind of wild dog. But when was the last time you heard of wolves or coyotes attacking farmers' wheat or corn crops? Petobee is a family-owned business that produces premium raw dog food from local ingredients. Our products are preserved through freezing, not chemicals or heat pasteurization. Do your dog and yourself a favor and start feeding your dog according to their design with Petobee Premium Raw.
Wolf Dog Radio, you're running with the pack.
San Francisco was coexisting with coyotes. Uh-oh, here we go. The San Francisco Recreation and Park partners with Project Coyote, the San Francisco Animal Care and Control, and San Francisco Dog to share the best practices for coexistence in an urban setting. Please listen to these important messages from Project Coyote.
Coyotes are native to California and native to the Bay Area. They have a pivotal ecological role even in our urban ecosystems. We need to just know that they're here and know what kind of behaviors we can implement to mitigate any kind of negative encounters.
San Francisco Animal Care and Control believes in coexisting with wildlife. People have asked us if there's any way we can eliminate the coyotes. And really there isn't. Some cities across the country and in California have tried that. And when they've culled the coyote population, more coyotes have come back within weeks. People have asked about trap and release, and the state has assured us they will never give us a permit to relocate a coyote. As the saying with wildlife goes, a fed animal is a dead animal. We need people to stop feeding wildlife. We need people to secure their garbage cans. If you're at the parks, we need you to deposit your refuse in the garbage can. If the garbage can is full, please pack it out with you.
My name is Sally Stevens, and I'm the chair of the San Francisco Dog Owners Group, or SF Dog. And I think there's a couple things that dog owners can do, especially to help peaceful coexistence. One is to never, ever, ever let your dog play or chase a coyote. Another is to never, ever feed a coyote. And the third one is to always be aware of where your dog is and what it's doing. The other final point is, in an area where you know that there are coyotes, you might want to keep your dog a little closer to you than you otherwise would.
We're here today in Stern Grove essentially teaching people about hazing. And essentially what we're doing with hazing of coyotes is showing our dominance and showing that we are essentially big, bad, and loud. Our message is you need to keep hazing until that coyote leaves the area to send them a message and to teach them that they need to remain wild and wary.
Krista Ward, our resident vet tech, is in the house and coming to you.
The Vet Tech is in.
Thank you for listening to The Vet Tech is in. My name is Krista Ward, and tonight we are going to be discussing reproductive issues. Those of us familiar with daytime game shows on television will fondly recall Bob Barker ending each episode of The Price is Right by telling the audience to have their house pet spayed or neutered. He typically prefaced this phrase with the rationale that doing so helps control the pet population. Millions of pets are euthanized every year, so population management is a good reason, of course, to have your female dog spay. However, it is far from the only one of consequences. There is a popular calculation that still gets bounced around on occasion, It's the one in which a single unspayed female dog, left to her own devices, can produce 67,000 new dogs within 6 years' time. This is a broad generalization, but can easily become true over time with the already overwhelming population issues of dogs and cats on the planet. Another issue is mammary gland tumors and breast cancers. What is known in humans as breast cancer also affects intact female dogs. The numbers are actually alarming. According to the Veterinary Society of Surgical Oncology, between 23 and 34% of intact female dogs will develop a mammary tumor. There are a couple of major kinds of growths, also known as neoplasms, classified as malignant and benign, that afflict the mammary glands of female dogs as they reach seniority. While the specific and actual causes of benign mammary gland tumors and malignant cancers remain unknown, there is clear evidence of a link between the growth of mammary gland tumors and hormones produced during a female dog's estrous cycle. Mammary tumors in female dogs seem to require the presence of sex hormones to begin growing, though they are no longer necessary once the tumor is there. These tumors can affect any major part of the mammary gland, from the connective tissues that link the glands to the milk ducts to the areas around each gland. Malignant tumors can easily spread. Female dogs have between 8 and 10 mammary glands, and aggressive breast cancer in an unspayed female dog can be a death sentence any time, particularly between 5 and 10 years of age. The standard spaying procedure before a dog's first estrous cycle, or heat, practically eliminates the risk of mammary tumors completely. Another issue is perianal fistula. Far less common than mammary tumors, but more common than tumors in any of a female dog's other reproductive organs, the uterus and the ovaries especially, perianal fistulas are another health issue that early spaying can help to avoid. Like mammary tumors, perianal fistulas tend to affect female dogs as they age and are seen most frequently in dogs over 7 years old. What is a perianal fistula? It is a condition in which an abnormal linkage or tunnel is formed between two sets of tissues in the area around the anus. A female dog with perianal fistula can have difficulty defecating, but that is only the tip of the iceberg. The unnaturally connected tissues form small holes around the anus which easily grow, expand, leak, and become infected. Essentially, these fistula are perpetually oozing, bleeding, and horrid smelling. They require medical treatment to resolve, from antibiotics and antiseptics to radical dietary changes and surgery, including tail removal in some cases. For those who do not spay their female dogs because of the cost of the procedure, it is a pittance compared to the cost of treating a perianal fistula. Dogs who are spayed have a reduced risk of developing this condition later on in life. Pyometra is by far the most common outcome, exceeding both mammary tumors and perianal fistula, of leaving a female dog intact. It is also the easiest to prevent by having your dog spayed. What is a pyometra? Put simply, it's a condition in which pus accumulates within the uterus. Secondary infections that arise when a female dog develops pyometra are even more dangerous to her health and requires immediate care to prevent death. How does all of this get started? In the standard estrous cycle, white blood cells do not enter the uterus while the organ's lining thickens to prepare for pregnancy. If there is no pregnancy, that lining is not sloughed off and excreted as in the human menstrual cycle, but absorbed over time back into the body. After several consecutive estrous cycles without a pregnancy, cysts can begin to form in what remains of the uterine lining. If the cervix closes and bacteria are present in the uterus, the infection can take hold. Most cases of pyometra begin within 8 weeks of the end of an estrous cycle, and the severity of the condition depends on whether her cervix is open or closed. Closed pyometra has been linked to appendicitis in humans and can become life-threatening with little warning. Open pyometra within the cervix is easier to detect. Like perianal fistula, it is accompanied by a noticeable leakage. Pus will become more visible, drainage from the affected dog's uterus, and out through her vagina as the infection progresses. Working in my field, I'm commonly given excuses by owners who do not want to spay or neuter their dogs for one reason or another. I am met with the common phrase of, he will be less of a man, or she will never get to experience what it's like to be a mother. I assure you, that is all in your head, and it is more of a personal problem than anything else. Your pet does not sit around pining over becoming a mom one day, or if his testicles are larger than his neighbor's. The responsible thing to do is to set human pride aside and do the right thing by Buffy and Muffy, spay or neuter, as early as possible to reduce any risks. I am also met with the statement, they will get fat and lazy and will have no desire to work anymore. This is also untrue. I have met many working dogs that are altered and are performing their desired tasks that are asked of them. As in women who have hysterectomies, hormones do change, but we must adjust our pet's diet and exercise routines to fit the change in hormones. There are far more benefits to spaying and neutering your pets, and so many risk factors can be eliminated. Please do your research and speak with your veterinarian if you have any questions. Thank you for listening to The Vet Tech Is In. My name is Krista Ward, and have a blessed night.
Here come the Cajun man, the Jerry Lewis, coming up out the swamp with that there crawdad bag over him shoulder. Hear him be.
Hi there, this is Jerry, and you're listening to the Wolf Tejas Den. I've got a few little gripes tonight, a lot to get off my chest. I think everybody ought to pay attention and listen. Wolf dog people, what is the problem? You know, there are things going on I just, for the life of me, can't understand. With the age of the Internet and the availability of information, all the educational sites and the Facebook groups, people are still making horrible decisions and doing incredibly stupid things. For a few examples, just recently I've seen a man with short fences and no dig guards and releases his animals to run and then scoffs at people trying to explain why that's a bad idea. And recently, a breeder that had to give up their animals, someone had to go thousands of miles to drag them back to safety, recently acquired 9 more animals, and now they're having to get rid of them as well due to being out of compliance with the law in their area. Duh. Then there's the breeder that sold more animals to the guy whose child had his arm tore off by the family's wolf dog. I think that was in Washington State. Great lengths were gone to save the wolf dog and was successfully accomplished, but the neglectful owners were replenished with more animals. You know, there are thousands of wolf dogs purchased from backyard breeders every year and sold to anyone with the money. You know, you would think that common sense alone would dictate that buying an animal that's part predator like a wolf would need to be well thought out in advance, but it seldom happens. There should be home checks on the breeder, just like there should be home checks on the buyers. That's a novel idea, huh? I tell you what, if folks would do that, there would be a day of reckoning for some of these hot shots with the gorgeous pictures on a beautiful web page, when in actuality, their places are just as sinfully horrible that you wouldn't even be allowed to visit some of them. Then you have some in the community that are just simply big mouths and narcissists, hell-bent on revenging themselves upon anyone that doesn't agree or hold them on high by any means necessary, including lies and slander. Well, I thought we all loved the dogs, but some are involved because they just love the money, the notoriety, and themselves. You know, it's real easy to paint a pretty picture and be somebody on the silver screen. There are a lot of rescues out there that get little to no support from Wolf Dog people. They're big name rescues and sanctuaries raking in tens of thousands of dollars that only rescue animals that will turn them a buck, while the overburdened smaller sanctuaries struggle and do without. There are a lot of rescues of owners and wolf dogs going on behind the scenes daily. Some of them are easy fixes and have requested the help, and others are so horrific it would make you puke if you knew what was really going on. Well, if we don't police ourselves, someone else is gone. And there are a lot of people out there fighting everyone else's battles for them every day, for the animals. We should support them. So please, please do your research before standing behind or with anyone or any place. There's an awesome, excellent organization we should all get behind and support. It's the National Lupine Association. It should be a prerequisite for owning a wolf dog, in my opinion. I sure hope people wake up and get their shit straight before it's too late. You know, that's all I got for tonight. I'm going to stop right there, folks. Thank you very much for listening. Have a great day. This has been the Wolf Tejas Den.
No going back now.
Hello, this is Natasha Woodall, Vice President of Texas Wolf Dog Project and Shelter. We are an all-volunteer and donation-based 501c3 rescue and adoption facility dedicated to saving as many adoptable wolf dogs and northern breed dogs in the state of Texas as well as surrounding areas. This is based off of available foster homes, suitable adoptive homes, and of course financial resources for veterinary care. We support responsible ownership and public education, as well as promoting education for other rescue groups, shelters, and animal control facilities concerning proper wolf dog identification, evaluation, and care. For more information on adoption, events, volunteer work, and how to donate, please visit our website at www.texaswolfdogproject.org or email us at info@texaswolfdogproject.org or visit us on Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you, Natasha.
This is Linda Michaels, and you are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Thank you to Krista and Jerry for your words of wisdom and your insights. Our next broadcast on Wolf Dog Radio will be on March 13th of this year, 2018. Our topic will be wolf dog artists, who some of them are, and what crafts and artwork they create, hosted by Sky Phoenix, as she talks with the artists and discusses the storefront that Wolf Dog Radio will be utilizing and bringing on to our website to offer artists somewhere to sell their original creations. Are you an artist or creator of unique items that aren't mass-produced but made with your lovely, gorgeous, talented fingers and hands? Contact if you are. And if you're interested in our storefront, at glargent@wolfdogradio.com. A huge thank you for Greg Hill from the Wood River Wolf Project for the education and commitment he has demonstrated as project coordinator and to everyone associated with WRWP. The success of this project highlights the truth that being shoot and scoop logic is not logical at all. It has been proven by this project that depredation is greatly reduced and almost stopped when non-lethal deterrents are used and managed by trained owners, managers, and ranchers. 90% lower than the rest of the state of Idaho, with zero depredations in the test area. The removal of problem wolves will always be an option, an option that has been shown to be greatly reduced with WRWP's hundreds of thousands of acres of heavily grazed sheepland. I hope that this fact and the message is allowed to be introduced not only in other areas of the USA, but globally to combat the rising slaughter of wolves in Europe because of ingrained fears and gross misrepresentation and misinformation regarding sheep losses by wolves perpetrated by the sheep farmers and their owners. Become informed. This information is but a keystroke from your computer. If only you take the time to become informed. Thank you for listening. If you have any questions or ideas for an upcoming broadcast, please email us at questions@wolfdogradio.com and come check out our website at wolfdogradio.com for more information. May the howls we all love to hear never be silenced. Truth through education. Thank you and good night.
You are listening to Wolf Dog Radio.
Remember to plant the seed of knowledge.